So, and it's a pleasure actually for me to introduce the first keynote today for the conference, Tacit Engagement in a Digital Age. So, Jeff Mulgan, who I've also had the pleasure to work with many times across the last few years, is the chief executive of Nesta. And I'm going to give a little bit of background on Nesta because I know we're an international crowd here, and then some more on Jeff's personal side too. So, Nesta actually is a very special organization, started in 1998. And it originally, Nesta stood for National Endowment for Science, Technology and the Arts. Now, Jeff's been chief executive since 2011 and has moved it forward significantly. So today we talk about it as our innovation foundation. And I think in the UK we're very lucky to have this quite unusual interface that is there between many of us working in the scene and actually the policy and governmental scenarios out there. So Nesta actually has been involved in really in improving innovation systems in the UK and beyond. It's now working as an independent foundation in over 50 countries worldwide, and it hits many areas of work, and I'm just going to mention a few: evidence and data and policy research, social action, the health sector, government innovation, creative economies, and futures, particularly looking at futures all the time. So Jeff, previous to Nesta, of course, also had a life before 2011. Various roles, actually, linked to the UK government, the government strategy unit and head of policy for the Prime Minister's office. First director of the think tank Demos, which many of you may have heard of. He was a director of policy for Tony Blair and a chief advisor for Gordon Brown, MP. And also has a long career, I think, in reporting and writing, BBC, television, radio. An Oxford University graduate, Jeff is actually a visiting professor at London School of Economics at the UCL, University College London, Melbourne University, and a senior visiting scholar at Harvard University. He also co-chairs the World Economic Forum group looking at innovation and entrepreneurship in relationship to the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and an international advisory committee for the Mayor of Seoul, plus he does do advice into prime ministers' offices in UAE, the Scottish Government, and the Finnish Innovation Agency. And in 2005, he was given a CBE by the Queen, I guess. You probably receive it from the Queen directly. So just to wrap and hand over to Jeff, I just wanted to mention two particularly relevant parts of his work which relate to today. Jeff's a prolific writer and commentator. I actually am amazed by how much you do get out there into press and media, but also books, numerous books. But to particularly mention his most recent book, Big Mind, How Collective Intelligence Can Change Our World, which was published by Princeton University, and which I know he will refer to today in this input, the keynote. And that links into an action that he's managed to make happen through Nesta, which is that in 2018, Nesta set up the Centre for Collective Intelligence Design. And that was just a really amazing point in time for many of us to actually see this breakthrough happen, to get this taken seriously as a proper centre, exploring how human and machine intelligence can work together to tackle social challenges. And this centre is very practically approaching this. So we're starting to see real world results coming from this. So a pioneer in the global fields of social innovation. Welcome to Jeff Mulgan.
Thank you. Do I need to use your mic?
No.
This one works. Okay. Well, thanks, Ghislaine, and thanks for the invitation from Satinder. So I originally wanted to come to this event to learn and hear from people who knew stuff, and then it transpired the price of admission was I had to say something. So this is me saying something. What I'm going to talk about is about half some reflections on tacit knowledge, on what is tacit knowledge, some theoretical questions and approaches, and then I'll share not so much what's in my book, which you might read, but some of the practical ways we're trying to apply that in what I call intelligence design, most of which is trying to integrate machine intelligence and human intelligence around practical issues from employment and cancer to the sustainable development goals. And for those of you who don't know Nesta, we do quite a lot. I'm not sure you can actually see the screen.
No, it is
Is it Make It Later? We do quite a lot on AI as an investor, as a convener, as a researcher. I won't talk much about that, but if you're interested, we've got a series of research studies using data, and indeed we've designed some search tools, which we launch next in the autumn, mapping the global AI research field in terms of geography, co-occurrences of research. This was a project on women shaping AI, and we're now running two, and it will soon be three, quite big funds commissioning AI around public services. This one launched 2 months ago is on education, working very closely with teachers to design AI tools which actually work in real-world contexts, which most, a lot of edtech doesn't. Another one on adult skills, helping the people most threatened by automation in their jobs, again, mobilizing technology to help them. And a third one I'm not allowed to mention yet, but hopefully will be launched in September, if we still have a government in September, which nobody knows. Even Ghislaine with all her futures experience. Now, that's slightly better. So, actually, could you... So some reflections on Tacit, and I assume you've all kind of read the literature, Polanyi and so on. So that literature all describes Tacit as, you know, what is understood, not expressed, hidden, implied, things you're really skillful at but can't say how or why. Interesting sort of set of theories, but in some ways what's striking is it's mainly defined as a negative. It's what isn't codified, formalized, and so on. And almost certainly, and I guess this is one of the things you'll be exploring, is a multiple phenomenon. And one of the issues for me is, what do we have the right language for describing the different kinds of tacitness? And if you think about a violinist, what do I put there? Footballer, a leader, therapist, monk, you know, what is tacit in their expertise, their skill, is probably very varied. And I'm sure Ghislaine will come on to this. You know, some is in some ways embodied, some is intuitive, some is, embedded heuristics. I would love to hear the best accounts you all have of how to distinguish these. And similarly, if we look at the domains you have in a university like this, interesting to think through each domain how much can be represented in its work. So architecture is a good example. I have spent a lot of last week with architects. There are fantastic AI tools for helping design buildings and think through how walls fit and plumbing and so on. And then there's a whole body of architectural knowledge which cannot be quite represented, formalized, and so on. And Christopher Alexander's work is really interesting, I think, on trying to almost define the undefinable in architecture. And there's a similar issues in, you know, surgery, history, music, sport, etc. In the sort of dominant Western scientific tradition, of course, I think there is a bias towards representation, towards trying to make knowledge codified, visible, interrogatable, and so on. And in a way, computer science is a sort of logical, you know, a successor to other Enlightenment traditions of knowledge as represented, and the process is representable as well. But there are, and that leads to a whole view of computer science, very strong in this city, as extracting tacit knowledge, expert systems, replicating, and I'll be fascinated in New York this session at the V&A, you know, the movements of a craftsman so it can be embodied in the arm of a robot, or for that matter, using machine learning to find very different routes to an end than the tacit knowledge of the human. And I guess our assumption has been, or many people, is that AI will accelerate all of those sort of extractive, replicative processes. But there are very different traditions. I many years ago, trained as a monk. And in the Buddhist tradition, a lot of knowledge is very much conceived as unknowable, is beyond representation. And indeed, a lot of wisdom comes from being aware of that which cannot be represented in language or indeed in any other forms. And I think there's also something perhaps to explore in the next couple of days, which is the literal meaning of tacit, which is silence. You know, what is the role of silence in very data-rich environments where the collective monkey mind, you know, crowds out any kind of deep thought reflection? And a sort of final comment there is that I don't know if anyone here works on the field of wisdom studies. But there's a really interesting subdiscipline of wisdom studies, which of course is almost unknown by universities, which has tried to study what are the common features of wisdom in multiple civilizations and parts of the world. And to summarize quite a rich literature, a lot of what most cultures view as wisdom is not just the integration of ethics into judgment, but highly contextual decision-making, which is really attuned to the specificities of time and place and people. So it's almost opposite to Turing's or algorithmic computation concepts, which are standardized and universal. And I think there's a really, I explore this a bit in my book, interesting tension between what the world knows about wisdom and its now dominant forms of thinking about knowledge, data, and information. I think they almost point in opposite directions. So my main interest, I guess, and what I want to open up here is a conversation about intelligence design. And I guess our main, and I'll come to this in a minute, our main interest is how do you make, let's say, the system of healthcare in a city or transport or whatever, intelligent in a recognizable way? And how does that require probably awareness of multiple kinds of knowledge and their combinations and interactions? So I'm going to do a minute or two each on five, I think, quite interesting angles of thinking about tacit knowledge before turning to collective intelligence. And these are slightly random, but I hope at least will prompt some thought. So the first is thinking about general purpose technologies. You'll have many people, again, in the university who've worked on GPTs. And I've been recently trying to think of AI, what are the parallels to AI which can help people think about what could happen in the next 20 or 30 years. And for me, almost any of the big GPTs offer useful insights. And this is the car I've chosen here. If you look at the last 140 years of the car, there is a story of technology development, hybrids, electric cars, blah, 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 sat navs. But you can only understand this evolution in its interaction with rules, road marking, speed limits, emissions, all these different kind of rules, with skills and tacit knowledge, some overt, some tacit, in the public, millions of people, some of the time being safe to drive these metal things around, not killing too many people, and then social norms, like around drink driving, polluting, and interesting, idling now is becoming a socially unacceptable activity in some places because of its pollution effects, and then the whole series of complementary innovations like supermarkets and suburbs. So in a way, you have to sort of think of those in a systemic way, and what's striking with any GPT is the complementary rules, norms, and innovation become more complex, more ethical, more detailed, and the tacit knowledge deepens in tandem with the codified knowledge. And I think that my prediction for the next 20 or 30 years of AI is it will be something very like that and very unlike what most of the AI techies think it will be, because they have a very linear tech sort of an ahistorical view. So that's one angle on tacit. The second is on supervision. This is a picture of the crash, I guess a year and a half ago, in Tempe, Arizona, when a self-driving Uber killed that pedestrian. There you see. Now, it's a really interesting, it's a little story that, because as this audience will probably know, it wasn't actually the AI which killed the pedestrian. It was the human supervisor who was meant to be supervising the car, was watching YouTube videos at the time in the car, and so actually overrode incorrectly the algorithms. But I think what this is leading to is a really interesting interplay we're beginning to see in different fields of humans supervising AI. Facebook now has, 20,000 people supervising its algorithms to try and stop fake news. I think we'll get the same in many other fields like driverless cars, surgery, but also increasingly using AI to supervise humans. If you're up before a judge, you'd probably like an AI to tell you if that judge is making so a wildly biased judgment, which is quite out of line with what they should be doing. The same may apply to teachers, doctors, and others. So there's the emergence, I think, of a really quite subtle field of mutual supervision of algorithms and people, especially in high-risk domains. This relates then to AI ethics. And here I'm probably going to annoy a few people in the room. There is an extraordinary AI ethics boom happening globally. Schwarzman, in theory, gave $150 million to Oxford on this last week, though it turns out it's mainly for a concert hall. But anyway, there's in some ways two, to slightly caricature, two competing views. One is that what you need for AI ethics is a series of principles, or almost algorithmic principles of transparency, applicability, liability, and all these sort of things. And there's a huge proliferation of codes and guidelines, and we produce some of our own. I've written them too. But I think that actually most of the times gets this completely wrong, and that all the real usefulness of AI ethics will come from specific cases applying heuristics in non-algorithmic ways. And that, again, is reinforcing what I said about wisdom studies, and it's the lesson of medical ethics. Almost everything turns out to be much more subtle, contextual, and the useful knowledge comes up almost from cases, not deduced from principles. And that's why I think about 90% of AI ethics work will turn out to be useless, because it's almost starting from the wrong assumptions about tacit knowledge. Anyway, that's something to argue about, even though lots of people get lots of money from the boom. Then I want to say a little bit about social creativity. Hubert Dreyfus' name is on the table out there, and some of you may know his amazing book on disclosing new worlds. And I think there's a really interesting story about the role of tacit knowledge in social creativity. So if you look at the literature on social machines and the internet, in a way, they all acknowledge that these are very unlike, as it were, classic Turing logic, because they are creating new ends as well as new means all the time. Whenever you have a community, Nigel Shadbolt's work on social machines really emphasizes this. There's also, I think, Dreyfus writes a little bit about this, a sort of dialectical process which goes back to Hegel. Probably no one now reads Hegel at all, do they? Ah, there's something. Yeah, and although he's always been unfashionable, in a way, his insights on social creativity, I think, are really important, which, you know, crudely, are that any process of transformation requires externalization. Knowledge has to go away from its kind of existing social, institutional, intellectual roots to be externalized, to discover itself, and then re-internalized back into society. And Dreyfus's work is very much about this as well in social entrepreneurship and creativity, that there's a sort of feeling your way to the new which requires externalization and internalization, which must be involving some kinds of tacit knowledge, but I'm not quite sure what they are. And they require sort of synthetic abilities which are, as I say, different from what computation can do. And sort of final example of a different angle on the tacit is thinking about systems. So a lot of our everyday work is trying to think about things like how would you shift to a zero carbon economy, or really reduce obesity, or and so on. And there's, a large literature on complex systems. Not all of it's very good, but there's a really interesting pattern which isn't talked about so much, which is that almost every time anyone tries to formally model a system, it falls apart. And I say this partly because the Alan Turing Institute believes you can do everything with digital twins. And I've yet to see a single system where actual formal modeling is useful, whereas, because they drown in noise, whereas small models, in some ways more toy models, can offer really useful insights. And then what turns out to happen is that people learn a sort of craft skill of where do you influence, prod, adjust, reshape that system. That's what the best policymakers try and learn. And again, there's, I think, a contrast between, as it were, an over-formal theory of systems, which I'll say never works, and this sort of cultivated tacit knowledge of system changes in reality. Again, very like the Fernando Flores Dreyfus work of 20 or 30 years ago. So that's a few sort of almost warm-up angles. They're more questions than answers for thinking about the interaction of tacit and formal knowledge in the world today, from thinking about what will happen to AI in the next 20 or 30 years to how do we solve climate change. So What I'm going to focus on now, my next 10 minutes or so, is, as Ghislaine said, what we're doing in this new centre at NESTA, our Centre for Collective Intelligence Design, which is trying to explore how human and machine intelligence can be combined to develop innovative solutions to social challenges. And some of the work of this centre is a bit theoretical. We hope to be launching a new academic journal. We've got a whole series of research grants around the world, which you probably can't see on everything, but if they're all on the website from Southampton, ATI, Hong Kong, all exploring different ways of combining, well, nearly all AI and CI around problem solving. And we're trying to cultivate a research community in this space. But I was going to say a little bit about where we're coming from more broadly in the theory and practice before then diving into what that means for Tacit. One of the things we've tried to do is rediscover the history of collective intelligence. And my favorite example, even though this is Cambridge, is the Oxford English Dictionary, which, if you haven't read the history of the Oxford English Dictionary, invented a whole host of organizational principles very dominant now, essentially mobilizing tens of thousands of volunteers in very structured ways to map the entirety of the English language and its meanings. So almost everything Wikipedia did was actually pioneered, not in Oxford, in fact, it was in London, by the OED. So an extraordinary feat of collective intelligence. There's more recently a whole series of examples of experiments, like the NASA Red Balloon Challenge, challenging teams to find weirdly hidden red balloons around America and to come up with methods of mobilizing communities of strangers to find them. They nearly always were found within a few hours, using clever mobilizational methods. And we've been tracking all sorts of examples like this one, Dana Lewis, who invented, with a community of collaborators, an artificial pancreas and a sort of data sharing tool to create a collective intelligence out of patients who weren't being served well by the medical system. We've just started this year a project drawing on the HFC, which is a US intelligence services hybrid forecasting competition, trying to combine human predictions using various kinds of tacit knowledge with AI to forecast, will the war with Iran start in August or September? Interesting questions like that. And we've actually been running an open, you can all take part, predictions exercise this year on British stuff like Article 50, will there be a Brexit, and so on. And the aim is then to look back at the patterns of who turn out to be good predictors or not by gender expertise and so on. And there's a whole host of examples of collective intelligence that's in the world today, in business, like Duolingo or Lego or Siemens, in citizen science, and in health. And if you're interested, we've been mapping the global research community. That is a summary of using machine learning to analyze the current research patterns on collective intelligence and their proximity. So I won't go into that. What I will focus on, though, is in some ways a little bit of the theory. So one of the very simple starting points we found really useful in thinking about intelligence in real environments is that just like the human brain, they depend on a number of different elements being combined. Observation, live models, analysis, prediction, memory, motor coordination, creativity, judgment, and wisdom. That's what it means for you as an individual to be smart, I hope, in your own life, your relationships, your work, whatever it may be, is the combination of all of those things. This should be blindingly obvious, but it's missing from almost all computer science, strangely. And of course, some of these are highly influenced by technology, and others very little so far. So almost any serious exercise of intelligence has to be a hybrid of machine and human because of the state of technology. And indeed, as you move down, you're moving more towards what is now at least tacit. Certainly, as I say, wisdom, judgment, and a large amount of creativity. So that's the first really important, most theoretical point if we're looking from a systems point of view. And that's even clearer if you think about learning loops. So again, a simple bit of theory which we found really useful is to think of any intelligent system, organization, or place being good at successive learning loops, where first loop learning is essentially algorithmic, adapting thought and action within an existing model, framework, paradigm, using new data to adjust behavior. Where second loop learning is when you realize that runs into barriers and so you need a new category or model to think with. And third loop learning is where you're rethinking how to think. And I use the analogy of driving kids to school in the morning. First loop learning is where 2 days in succession you find a blockage in one road, so you change your route. Second loop learning is when your whole town becomes concerned about air pollution, and so you see your journey through a different category of health, and maybe climate change, not just mobility. And third loop is perhaps when you have an entirely driverless car town and you have an entirely new cognitive system. Now, this in some ways is the normal world of AI. There are some AI tools for new category creation, but not very good ones. And I'm not aware of any AI which can help you design a third loop, even though they will be part of the third loop. So again, tacit knowledge of different kinds becomes much more important as you go up through the loops. And this seems to be really important for understanding real-life complex learning processes. But again, missing from 99% of what's written on AI at the moment. So finally, where do we take this? Well, our interest then is how do you create what we call intelligence assemblies, which combine observation and data, models, analysis, memory, creativity, and action and learning in those loops around things that matter. So like unemployment, cancer, SDGs, etc. And we have some good examples we draw on. So we're quite interested in things like Google Maps as a prototype intelligence assembly. Google combined a whole series of startups or companies they bought, open APIs to draw on lots of creativity, and Google Mapmaker to draw on public input. So Google Maps is an assembly of sorts, though missing quite a few of the elements and not much tacit there. This is very much the non-tacit side. We're trying to do an equivalent now for jobs and skills and careers, and this is one of the live projects which I would like insights in. And in a way, our sort of metaphor there is what would the equivalent to a Google Maps be to help people plan their job, skills, and careers. So they could say, this is where I am, this is where I want to be, how do I get from where I am to where I want to be, perhaps with new skills, new experiences, and so I'm not poor or unemployed. And so to do that, we've done a lot of data harvesting. So we've looked at 40 million job adverts to analyze their skills and payment levels. Our team's created a whole data-driven taxonomy of skills, because you do have to have a shared taxonomy. And we've linked that to forecasts on jobs growth, jobs decline in the next 10 or 20 years, what skills will be in greater demand. I won't go into the detail. The key then is to turn that into usable forms for a teenager choosing GCSEs or a 50-year-old at risk of losing their job in a warehouse. What we haven't quite got right is how to combine in the tacit knowledge. So how, let's say, in Cambridge, let's say it's the construction industry, how do you get the fine-grained tacit knowledge of people who really understand that industry, what's happening to jobs and skills, and combine it with the more formalized data which we have harvested? And this is now a very live task and project, but I think we haven't quite got either the theory or the practice right on that. And yet I think this is going to be really, really important to lots of people's lives, that we can, in a sense, organize, tap, mobilize all sorts of kinds of quite subtle tacit knowledge. Democracy is another field in a very similar space. This is a diagram of VTaiwan, which is the most advanced application of collective intelligence thinking to a parliament under Audrey Tang, former a hacker. And they've tried to almost rethink the policy design process of a parliament through these series of stages, which try and gather the objective facts of an issue, with publication of facts on a wiki timeline, then a reflective stage of thinking about personal reactions, associations, emotions, images, using Polis, the AI tool for deliberation, an interpretive stage, including lots of face-to-face meetings, and then Parliament and government do decide in quite a traditional way. But the aim is to tap into the collective intelligence of society to guide decisions rather than jumping to them following a Daily Mail, you know, editorial or an opinion poll. And just 2 days ago, we published quite a detailed proposal for select committees in our parliament, how they could be drawing on some of these methods to be more effective as democracy. Strangely, none of the candidates to be our new prime minister has mentioned any of this stuff. But anyway, that's another. It will come. And of course, in this again, it's trying to formalise a whole series of kinds of tacit knowledge, experiences, views, emotions of the public is what makes this this interesting. And then finally, we're working at the moment with the UNDP, who are creating 60, what they're calling accelerator labs around the world. If you haven't, they're still hiring. These are some of the most interesting jobs around, to speed up achievement of the SDGs. And we've been designing their methods and the training program for these new teams, which will be from Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan to Malawi. And I was 2 weeks ago in Swaziland working with the team there on this. And in a way, what this is trying to do is a really slightly different approach to policy making and outcomes. And I won't go into the detail, but in some ways it's very simple what we're trying to do, is to break the task of bridging the gap between current SDG trajectories on something like sanitation and where they want to be into these 4 stages. And the first stage is better understanding of the problems. And what's interesting in the UNDP context, some of that is about data mining and crowdsourcing data and classic social science, but it's also trying to be experiential, to tap into the lived experience of, you know, farmers or refugees and so on. They're very explicit. This stage has to be formal and tacit integrated. Similarly, the seeking solutions stage, where we're trying to get them not to have clever people in a capital city writing a policy, but much more open processes of crowdsourcing, et cetera. Again, this is trying to tap into often the positive deviants, the people who are working really well against the grain, who are often doing that without a formalized expression of why their approach works. So again, this is trying to tap in both tacit and formal knowledge. And then decision and action processes, which embed the kind of 3-step learning I described. In some way, none of this should be rocket science. It's far ahead of anything being done in Whitehall, I have to say, or most Western governments, which are in a sense don't have a much more traditional model of the intelligence design aspects. But it's potentially quite an exciting place to try and think through new combinations of formal and tacit. So, the final point I'll make in some ways is the obvious one. In all of this, I guess my interest is not so much in AI, but how do we combine AI, CI, collective intelligence, perhaps other kind of intelligences, into some kind of intelligence design method, discipline, practice, which can be useful. And one of my frustrations, I'm going to say something rude about universities since I'm in a university now. I've, for the last few years, been going around universities asking, what can you offer to help the sort of project I mentioned from the UN? And universities have, including this one, wonderful computer science departments, psychology departments, but they're not very helpful at all on this. The structures of disciplines, I think, are really not fitted to the contemporary need for intelligence design. And we're just beginning to see in the last 12 months a number of universities around the world creating courses and teams on this, but they're not the elite, they're not the top universities who, for reasons I think of status, find it very hard to adjust. So I'm trying to challenge Cambridge and perhaps some others to, in a sense, shake off their, their silos and become useful on this stuff, because we really need the brain power of the sort of brilliant people in this room and in this university. So, to recap, there are many kinds of knowledge with very varied degrees of representability, codification, formalization, and I think we need better maps and languages of the territory of what is tacit. I've given a flavor, I think, some of the interesting places where tacit and codified knowledge interact, like GPTs, ethics, social creativity, and system. I think in many of these, we will find that learning involves successive movements between codified and tacit, externalization and internalization. In a way, that is how you learn a sport. It's how you learn a musical instrument, too, is through that successive movement. But my pitch is that understanding and shaping these needs to be part of a broader intellectual and practical mission to grow a field of intelligence design. And it has to be not trapped in the perspectives of any one discipline. And I'm hoping to find allies in that quite big mission, actually. So, there we go. That's the state of my thought. Thank you.